Hey, you guys!
It's me, Daisha. Had you fooled for a second, didn't I? You're about to hear my talk with the fabulous Orly Shaham all about the piano, its evolution, its history, its music, and how, most importantly, you can use this time during quarantine to make your child into a musical prodigy using Orly's patented program. I'm just kidding. Mostly. We do talk about how to use some of the resources she's been releasing online to get your kid or even you started playing the piano. And you will enjoy this episode of Classical Classroom, money back guaranteed. And when you do, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review the podcast. I think that's it. Okay, now on with the show.
There's a rumor going around that classical music can be hoity-toity. But here in the Classical Classroom, we beg to differ.
Beethoven 5.
The idea that classical music is a zone where we have to feel restricted or we have to act in a certain way, you know, that's not going to be helpful going forward.
Isaiah is shaking with excitement. Oh, here.
I mean, there's just so many great parts of the opera.
He asked me to play his favorite spot in the first movement of the Brahms. And then he said, I started using those licks in my guitar solos.
How to be classical music rock stars, because there's not enough of that in this business.
Occasionally, I would plug in the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
I don't change my voice.
And talking to classical
voice. I'm playing classical music now. I mean, it's the same 12 notes. That's what's so cool about it.
I'm Daisha Clay, a classical music newbie, and I'm trying to learn all I can about the music. Come learn with me and the classical music experts I invite into the Classical Classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me today is pianist Orly Shaham. Orly has been on the show many moons ago. She talked with us from Aspen at the summer festival there about Brahms, and she has performed with major orchestras all over the world. Among the many things she does off stage, Orly does a children's series called Orly Shaham's Bach Yard and is a regular guest host and creative on NPR's From the Top. Today, she is going to teach me about the piano. Orly, welcome back to the Classical Classroom.
It is such a pleasure to be on with you. I just love what you do with this program.
Oh, thank you. Well, so let's give our guests a refresher about you. I want to know why you started playing the piano. How old were you? What drew you to the instrument?
You know, I think my story with a piano is not dissimilar to many other people's stories. You know, unlike most other instruments, the piano doubles as a piece of furniture that lives in your home. And we had a piano, and our piano was being used. One of my two older brothers was playing piano, and my mother had played it as a child. But, you know, there it was in the living room. And so I just gravitated to it whenever other people weren't using it. I started to make noise, and I remember myself as a sort of four-year-old, five-year-old, just constantly going over to the piano and trying to see what I could do with it. You know, it's really a unique instrument that way. You can't just wander over to the flute and you know, be able to make a sound. It doesn't work that way. So I was really jealous as a little kid that both my brothers, my older brothers, played instruments at that point, and the piano was the one that I could go to. I think that's really what drew me to it. And it's only as an adult and as a professional musician, and at this point in my life, in my 40s, where I realized that I was, what a stroke of luck that I was drawn to this instrument that has the most vast and interesting repertoire and the most variety of possibilities for what you can do with it, what kind of ensembles you can put it into, and that really represents an entire orchestra. So, but that was all, none of that was by design.
Right. It was just because it was sitting in your house, which I think is so, so interesting. When I've asked a lot of artists about why they play what they play, you know, I'm expecting some, you know, I was really drawn to the beautiful sound that I heard, and I had to go and find how that was being made, and that's how I came to play. You know, but most often it was like, well, this instrument was there.
somebody shoved it in my face, or it happened to be sitting in my house, and that's how I started playing.
Well, but, you know, as a little kid, what I was really drawn to actually was the harp. And I loved watching harpists. My brothers, as I said, my brothers played, so I would hang out at their community music school concerts, you know, in this was in Jerusalem when I was really little, before we even came to America. And I remember one of their, you know, schoolmates played the harp, and I just thought this was the greatest thing. But of course, I was way too tiny to even consider playing such a big instrument, and I think maybe that's why the piano felt like a good substitute. And boy, am I glad. Can you imagine lugging that thing around all the time?
You know, it's really funny because I just spoke with Yolanda Condonassis about the harp, and I was like, how on earth did you start playing that as a little kid? I mean, it's massive. So apparently she started on this really small kind of harp for that very reason. But
may I say, Yolanda is one of my absolute favorite people, and she is a remarkable harpist. If I could have possibly been a harpist at her level, then maybe it would have been worth doing.
She's the coolest. She is so much fun to talk to too. But I wanted to go back to something that you said, and that is that the piano is kind of like a piece of furniture. I mean, it is essentially a piece of furniture. People put, you know, photographs up on the pianos in their homes. And it's like one of those instruments that I feel like has been in our culture, in Western culture, and I'm sure other cultures around the world, like just this given, like it's just this very normal thing. But that wasn't always the case. Like we kind of got to this modern piano that we know and love today somehow. How did we get to the modern piano? How did it start?
You know, the piano is a fascinating study in technology and how technology evolves. The idea of some kind of keyboard that is attached to some kind of mechanism that in one way or another plucks a string was finally sort of in full bloom in the 1600s, certainly by the middle of that century. And because the world was very local then, what that instrument looked like in one city was only in certain ways similar to what it looked like in another city, right? So word would spread, oh, you can sort of have a mechanism that does this. And local people would come up with their own solutions of how to actually make that mechanism work for the instrument that they were building. And local builders often experimented within their own lifetimes with how they worked on things. So the instrument was pretty much constantly evolving from the very beginning with the harpsichords. Through, you know, different things that we might call pianoforte, and, you know, long way to go, at least two centuries, if not perhaps three, before something that we could call the modern piano. But during that time, there were so many gradations. And one of the things that I think is most fascinating about that is that the composers themselves were often the drivers of the technology. I mean, if you think of the sort of analogous situations today with apps, it suddenly makes perfect sense. So, for example, Beethoven was in constant written communication with Broadwood, who was making pianos in England, and he was saying, well, the piano needs to do more of this and more of that, and you need a pedal that does this, and you need more keys there, and, you know, and Beethoven was hardly the only one. Mozart had done that before. Bach was even involved with that in his own world, both with the organs and with the harpsichords. You know, so it was the composers. It was a kind of a very natural, very organic communication that went, here's what I hear. How can you help me make what it is that I hear? And how can you make it so that it's more standardized? It's really fascinating. It's an incredible social story. And then, of course, the question which you said, you know, a piece of furniture in somebody's house. Well, at first, it wasn't like, you know, Joe musician was going to have a keyboard in their house unless they had a patron who could pay for it, right? And it took a long time, and it very much parallels the history of the rise of the middle class in the late 19th century, early 20th, this idea that, oh, well, suddenly everybody can afford to have some kind of piano, usually a spinet, a smaller model, in their home. And that meant that they could recreate music in the home. I mean, remember, this is all still before even the LP. And so if you wanted to have music, not by going outside and finding a concert, really the best way to recreate it was on the piano. And the another history that I find absolutely fascinating is the history of transcriptions and sheet music. In the 19th century, publishers realized that everybody wanted to hear that opera, but you know, you couldn't just download the the digital recording. But if you could get the sheet music, and so many middle class or members of this new middle class, you know, were learning how to read sheet music and maybe had a piano in their home so they could play it. If you could do that, you could recreate that opera in your home. And so that was actually a huge market. Believe it or not, this was actually a way to get rich, was to publish transcriptions of operas.
That's amazing. Well, it's interesting to think of it in terms of apps, because like typically an app comes up because somebody, you know, sees a need, you know, for a phone to be able to do a specific kind of thing, and then they develop technology to make the phone do this thing that it doesn't already do. And so what you're saying in this analogy is that the piano kind of came to be what we know of it today because of, like, it was sort of molded into to its current shape by the composers that we know and love, and then was popularized because people wanted to, like, bring this music into their homes. And that's so interesting, the cultural forces, the forces in the arts that, like, shaped it into what we know. And now it's just this sort of, oh yeah, it's the piano. It's like,
well, and now we take it so for granted, and it's so frequently. I've taught in a number of different kinds of situations, and I've taught also to students who are not actually music students, but I'm the one introducing them to music. And I find particularly in those contexts, a lot of them, when I ask if they've ever heard an acoustic instrument live, that acoustic instrument ends up being the piano. They may not have heard a violin live, or even a guitar live, a lot of them, that it's not an amplified guitar. But the piano, that they've heard.
Pianos are ubiquitous, and because of that sort of cultural history of, like, because, okay, so here's a question that kind of relates to this, which is, I think part of the reason for the popularity of the piano and how it spread and, like, wound up in people's homes so much is because it performs a lot of different functions. You kind of said something about it being an orchestra, or somebody said that to me.
Yes.
I'm totally...
No, I definitely said that.
Yeah, you did. Okay, it was you. So is it a percussion instrument? Is it a string instrument? You know,
is it a shoe polish? Is it a floor wax?
Exactly. It's all of those things. It's vitamin and vegemin.
Well, and I think that phenomenon, so around the beginning of the 19th century, the piano's role kind of moved from either being a solo instrument or actually being really part of the rhythm section to becoming more orchestral. And this happened simultaneously with the instrument also acquiring the ability to make more kinds of colors and different kinds of sonorities with the pedals that were introduced and that were becoming more effective, and also with the range of the piano increasing. And simultaneously, and not surprisingly, the composers were inspired by this. Again, they were also some of the impetus for these technological innovations in the first place, but they were also inspired by what was happening to make the piano function more like a giant orchestra, and to be able to imitate the sonorities that are coming from other instruments or from the voice. And you see this across the board. You see this with a Beethoven or with a Chopin, and certainly with, you know, by the end of the 19th century, with a Brahms, and then with Rachmaninoff, where the colors, the coloristic range that you're able to get out of this instrument is mind-blowing. And it is, none of that is because of the nature of the instrument itself. It's almost all because of the way the instrument is imitating others.
Right. Right. So interesting. So if you're a baby pianist, what are you going to start out playing? Like, what is the sort of standard, what are the pieces that, like, every pianist has to know, or what's called the repertoire?
Well, you know, luckily, there have been some incredible composers who have spent time writing beginner pieces. which is wonderful for us because it means you don't have to just play the horrific stuff. You can go pretty quickly into Tchaikovsky, who has a wonderful children's album that I played as, most of which I played as a kid. Some stunning little pieces that are so balletic and poetic and beautiful. You've got Schumann's Kinderszenen, which, you know, kids will be able to get. Some pieces are easier than others. Prokofiev wrote some spectacular, easy pieces. Kabalevsky, the Russian school just in general, exploded with this kind of pedagogic material. So, I mean, this may not be your first, you know, few months learning notes, but very soon thereafter, these come. And then, of course, there's the very famous Mozart C major piano sonata. Pretty much, like, if you reach that, then you know you've reached your first milestone in your piano studies.
You're an official pianist now.
You're
for real. Okay. And now for a quick break for some words about our sponsor. This episode of Classical Classroom is sponsored by Maestro Classics. They're the creators of Stories and Music, which is this recorded series that they made for kids and families. It's won more than 50 awards, not to mention general adoration from the people who listen to it. It features the London Philharmonic Orchestra, and it takes those musical stories and it brings them to life. It's one of those things where kids learn while they're having fun, without actually knowing that they're learning. And there's an activity book that goes along with it. It's a whole thing. Maestro Classics just announced a brand new recording in this series called Bach and the Organ. It's all about J.S. Bach, who you may have heard of on this very show, and it tells the story of his life while talking about the pipe organ, which, P.S., back in the day, was the most advanced mechanical instrument that had ever existed. And you can learn more about this album and the rest of the series at maestroclassics.com, and wait for it. You can also save 17% off of your order by using coupon code CLASSROOM. Yay! And now back to my conversation with Orly Shaham. I think we were talking about what piano students learn after the beginner stuff. When you reach that echelon, where do you go from there?
There are so many different schools of thought in music. Like everything else, musicians disagree, you know, like everyone else, musicians disagree on just about everything, including pedagogy. And there are different schools about how do you teach. Well, is it just, do you just sit down and do scales and arpeggios? And do you just spend most of your time doing exercises? I've always been of the belief that stuff is incredibly boring, and that is not a good way to turn people on. It's wonderful at some point, and there, as a teacher, you kind of have to know when that moment is when, okay, my student now can handle some of that slightly more tedious stuff in order to get these fingers in a better shape. It's not necessarily the best thing to start out with those. You know, I think for some students it is. It really depends on the personality. But there are so many shorter pieces by, you know, like some of the Chopin preludes that he intended as teaching pieces, or later on some of those etudes that he, for the more advanced student, very much intended those etudes to teach his students how to properly use their hand and how to really... extract from the piano all the different kinds of colors and sonorities that he could tell were there and that most people weren't getting.
Well, what's your, as a person who is an official pro, what's your favorite stuff to play? What do you enjoy playing?
You know, at the moment, I always say what I enjoy playing is what I'm working on. And I've been very lucky with that in my life, is that the repertoire is so huge that, and I've been so fortunate to be able to choose a lot of the time what I play. At the moment, I'm obsessed with two slightly different things, although in certain ways they're quite connected. One is the piano sonatas of Mozart.
Yeah, you've been doing so much work with Mozart stuff for a while since like...
I've just finished recording. Well, last summer I finished recording about 2/3 of the sonatas, and I'm planning to record the other third in the next few months. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those pieces, he wrote them. So the piano sonata at that time was not really a public piece. You wouldn't go out and perform it for your audience. You would perhaps perform it in a small, intimate salon kind of thing in somebody's home. Mm-hmm. They were mostly used as teaching pieces. So he was using them to teach his students, to develop their technique, and also to teach his students about composition. And so because of that combination, that he was both using them as teaching pieces and as compositional teaching pieces, and because, you know, in my humble opinion, Mozart was the first artist, you know, not to have been diagnosed with ADHD, but he probably should have been, he would get kind of bored easily with what he was doing. And so the wonderful result for us is that the 18 sonatas he wrote are all completely different, and they try out completely different ideas and techniques and forms and ways of putting things together, and they're filled with so many melodic ideas. I used to have a professor at Columbia when I was doing historical musicology there, who would say about Mozart that he would throw in everything but the kitchen sink from a melodic point of view. And it's totally true in every sonata. Like, the guy is, it's so many ideas, he just can't stop himself. And so for these kind of pieces, it's amazing the variety of sounds and textures and ideas, you know, explorations of mood and of key. I think I had, like many people do, I had kind of lumped the Mozart sonatas in my mind as some kind of group. And obviously they are, because they are all sonatas and they are all by Mozart, and they do all reflect a certain time period, you know, mostly the 1780s, a little bit before as well. But the reality is that they're so different one from the next. Yeah. They're amazing testaments to what you can do within a certain artistically bounded situation. You know, he was bounded by his time, he was bounded by the instrument, he was bounded by the market, in a sense, that he was putting this out for, which was either for his own performances, smaller performances, or for his students. And yet the creativity is boundless within them.
Huh. Well, you've clearly got a little personal love affair going on with Mozart's music. Well, tell me about Midweek Mozart, this thing you're doing right now.
So, Midweek Mozart has been a lot of fun to put together. Because I recorded these, and I had 12 sonatas sort of in the can, so to speak, and we hadn't released them yet. And when this pandemic hit and we all went home and stayed there, you know, a lot of people were putting all sorts of content on, you know, to pass the time. And it seemed to me that, especially in the first few weeks, everything was so unsettling and unsettled that the only proper way to soothe the soul was through some Mozart. So I decided to release one movement per week, not to bombard anybody with too much music to listen to, but, you know, between 5 and 10 minutes worth of Mozart every week, to just give us all a chance to center and to be in that incredible world of his, which is, I think, one of the reasons that his music is such a balm is he was raised on the theater. This was a child who ate theater for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
So he was very dramatic. One might say a drama queen.
Yeah, absolutely. So every sonata is, you know, everything that he ever wrote is so theatrical in its thinking, it transports you. And even if it's transporting you, even if it's not a literal, okay, one-to-one relationship, the idea is to take you to a fantasy world. This is where he lived, you know, this is where he spent his time. And his imagination was pretty much unstoppable. I mean, I'm sure, like, we're all thrilled to have his music, but it must have been really hard to be his parents. That's all I'm saying.
What you're doing another online thing too, these Backyard play dates, which is part of your, I think you had a series called, or have a series called, Orly Shaham's Backyard, and this is an outgrowth of that you're also doing, I've gathered, during quarantine. Tell me about that.
Well, this was, again, it grew out of the same thing, sort of realizing we're all in our homes, and I'm lucky to have two 12-year-olds at home with me. And I say lucky because I remember all too vividly what it was like to have two 5-year-olds at home with me, and I'm so glad that I'm not in this situation right now with two 5-year-olds. But I really, really feel for the people who are. And so, you know, this whole series, the Backyard, was always intended to be a child's first experience with live concert going. And so the concerts were, you know, they were never stuffy. They're never about sitting still all the time. And quite the contrary, a lot of them are about interaction and movement and participating in the music in a number of different ways. But all with the sort of goal that children of this age group, you know, preschool, maybe early elementary, they're transitioning to being able to sit still a bit more and to being able to be transported through listening only and to actually just, you know, really focus on what's coming in through their ears. And that was always the goal. And when this time period happened and I started thinking about the poor parents who have these kids at that age and can't take them outside and can't necessarily have them physically interact with music, I thought we better come up with a creative way of transitioning the playdates to online. So at least there's a way for kids to interact through the screen.
Today we're bringing you one of my favorite pieces from the Backyard, Stephen Mackey's Sneaky March.
With me,
yeah.
And maybe with our audiences. So a lot of the episodes include clips from our actual concerts so that you can interact with them. But then they're done from home, so which is where the kids are right now. They acknowledge the items that might be available in your home or not available in your home to interact with.
You'll need to get a little hanky, like this or like that. Really, any piece of cloth will do.
I've been really gratified by the kind of success it's had. It seems like a lot of people are watching, and I'm just hoping that it gives parents, you know, 5 to 10 minutes a week where, you know, and hopefully on repeat, where yeah. they're happy with what it is that their child is doing online.
It sounds like this is sort of a gateway drug for young would-be musicians.
Exactly.
To bring it back to the piano, if somebody was a young person, or any age of person, I guess, and wanted to start playing the piano, where do you think they should start?
Well, I think there's two really important ways to start. One is to get a keyboard, and while an actual piano may not be affordable in quite the same way it was, keyboards are. So to very physically just, you know, if you have a very young child, to just have them gravitate toward the instrument and play around and start to listen to sound. And, you know, while they're doing that, or, you know, during that same time period, to listen to lots and lots of music in your home. Because I think there's no better encouragement for kids to music than to hear it. The music sells itself. Like, there's really nothing you need to do except to make it available. And if it's playing and if they see you listening, they will gravitate. And then, of course, the next thing to do is to find the community music school that's closest to you and get a teacher. Make sure you have a nice chemistry between the teacher and your child, and get to work. Mm-hmm. You know, people come to me a lot and ask about that balance between sort of work and fun with an instrument, especially in the early years of study. And it's tough, you know. I mentioned I have two kids. It was tough for me with my two kids, and it was tough in different ways. It's tough because every child has a different relationship to the kind of drilling and, dare I say, tedium that is a necessary part of at least a little bit of a musical education, right? And every parent and child have a different relationship to how they handle that stuff. sometimes parents come to me and they're teaching their kids this language and they're doing this extra math and they're doing the gymnastics and they're also doing the instrument. They say, well, I don't know why my child won't listen to me when we're doing the instrument. And I say, well, I think maybe I know. Maybe there's just a few too many things. Like you just have to constantly be playing with that balance for you, for yourself, for your own sanity, and for your kids mm-hmm. with, okay, how many of the things that I'm doing do they have control over? Do they feel like are quote-unquote fun? And how many yeah. need to be done a certain way? And a good teacher-student right. combination will find that balance and will constantly reevaluate that balance in during those early years. I do think that
yeah.
you know there are amazing teachers out there for young kids who are just so good at threading that line, you know, and going only a little bit too far in each direction each time.
Yeah. This sounds like the premise for how this podcast works, which is hopefully you're having so much fun listening to me ask famous people like yourself dumb questions that you don't realize as a listener that you're also learning things.
I'm sorry, you haven't asked me any dumb questions yet. When are you going to start with the dumb questions?
I'll work on it. I feel like they're all, you know, very middle of the road elementary, I think that sort of, what is it, putting the grinding up the spinach into the cake,
you know, yes,
you're eating the yeah. So you're continuing to do midweek Mozart and Bachyard playdates, and those seem like really good places for parents to start too.
Absolutely. So it would be really fun for a kid to just listen to the midweek Mozarts, right? They don't need to yeah. do anything else. I find, I've always found, for whatever reason, kids seem to be really attracted to Mozart's music. But I have to say that when I do these Bachyard concerts live, I always begin the concert with playing a bit of solo Bach, just me. And this is, you know, the only prep I've done with them before that time is we do have a lot of interactive pieces in the concert hall before they even go to their seats. So they've already met the musicians, they've already done musical activities. But they sit down in their seats and they're very noisy, and I start playing solo Bach on piano every single time, never fails. Amazed that at the silence that falls, and it falls almost immediately, and if I play softer, it falls even more deeply. And it doesn't matter how young that particular audience is, you know, a bunch of 3-year-olds, or how you know, whether I'm doing it sort of at a music school where I can expect that some of these kids have been exposed before, or at a kind of community center where I think they probably have never heard anything like this before. It doesn't matter, any of that. It doesn't matter if it's in a big hall yeah. or in a small classroom. There's absolute silence because it's stunning. Music in its live form, right in front of your ears, it's miraculous. There is a reason that this is such powerful stuff.
Shaham, thank you so much for being on the show today. This has been incredible fun, and listeners, I hope you'll go check out Orly's online offerings if you're interested in learning the piano or have little ones at home who are. Orly, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much. It's always such fun talking with you. You make me think, and I feel like I learn just talking with you.
Hey, it's working. It's working. All right, Orly, take care.
Take care.
All right, everybody, that does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more episodes of Classroom, just go to classicalclassroomshow.com, where you can find past episodes, ways to connect with us, and ways to financially support the show. Don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review us wherever you listen. Thanks to the birthplace of Classical Classroom, Houston Public Media. Thanks to the fabulous Orly Shaham for being on the show again today. Thanks to the official mascot of Classical Classroom, Little Edie the Kitten. She's brand new to the staff and to the world. And if you follow us on Instagram, you can see her, and she is adorable. Thanks to me for saying words, but most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.